Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So typically when you give, I think, a science and faith or science and religion talk, it ends up, at least in part, being about potential or perceived conflicts between science and religion. This is not going to play a major role in this talk, but I just want to sort of plant ahead of time that if you want to ask questions about it, if there are any sort of conflicts you have heard or maybe you're not sure about how serious it is that has to do with astronomy, or as you hear about aliens, cosmology, definitely feel free to bring them up either today and tomorrow, and I'll do my best, but then I might also field some to Dr. Lemine. Instead, what I want to do with this talk is take a bit more of a medieval approach. And I think if we take the time of Thomas Aquinas, there would just have been a presumption that there's going to be coherence between different ways of understanding the cosmos. And that this is true when you look at the very big things. We'll focus for this talk on cosmology, so thinking about the sort of created material order as a whole. Or if you zoom in to the very small details, that might be more what you are studying in some of your different fields. And focusing, though, on the larger scales, I think is a nice case study for thinking about how to, in a productive way, dialogue between the theological accounts of creation and the scientific accounts of the beginning of the universe, or where sort of why the universe looks the way it is, which is the Big Bang cosmology part. So when we're talking about creation, we'll be focusing quite a bit on the creation account in Genesis and how different theologians, especially, of course, Thomas Aquinas, have thought about what that means and how to think about that in light of what we know sort of naturally about the cosmos. But I do want to put in front of you that for Thomas Aquinas, creation, the bringing into existence of things out of nothing, is not primarily sort of an action. It is primarily a kind of relationship. So we're thinking about creation. What Thomas will say is that for creation is not a change. And this is addressing where I think we might have as a not very helpful picture in the back of our head sometimes, that if we have creation out of nothing, is that we have this thing that's nothing and that is changed into something. And that is something that Thomas wants us to try to get rid of, however difficult it is to conceptualize nothing. I mean, we can't conceptualize nothing. So creation is not a change. It is the very dependency of the created act of being upon the principle from which it is produced. And thus creation is a kind of relation. And one of the things I would do is just, as budding scientists, is to encourage you to bring that with you into meditation, that when you're doing science, when you're studying creation, you are engaging in a way of strengthening that relationship that is already objectively present just from our radical dependence on the Creator. One of the things that this does very powerfully is to enable science. When the distinction between the Creator on the one hand and the created order on the other is so radically, radically present, there is no longer any possibility for conflict between God and God's action on the one hand and natural actions or natural causes on the other. And that is why, in some sense, it doesn't, like if you want to take a more sort of medieval approach, it doesn't really make sense to focus too much on conflicts, because you have already made this radical commitment to understanding the Creator as being fundamentally different and acting in a fundamentally different way from created things. But that doesn't mean that it's always simple to see that when we look at specific cases. And that's why I would say that totally invite questions about sort of specific instances where there might be seen like there should be a conflict between a natural cause and a supernatural cause. So we have that as creation. And then the question is, if we look around us, that's sort of how we define creation. If we look around us, do we see evidence of that we live in a created universe? And here comes the only sort of real objections to that I will raise in this talk. Because if you listen to like sort of contemporary voices, at least some of them, there are multiple sort of reasons that are given for why this sort of classical theistic understanding of the universe being created and being this radical dependency on God doesn't really make sense if you take sort of a objective approach and look at the universe. So at least the three that I've heard the most, and therefore that I will put in front of you, and then hopefully we'll be addressing them throughout this talk, is that first, well, it does not seem like we live in a created universe because the universe is well described by impersonal forces. So we don't need any sort of supernatural or purposeful agent to describe it. And if that sounds familiar to you, that would be one of the objections that Thomas Aquinas puts up in the Summa before he then refutes it with his five proofs for God's existence. The second one is that, well, if we look around us, it seems like the universe is full of chaos and destruction. And that is opposite what you would expect if a good governor and creator. And then the third one is that the universe, if we look at it, doesn't seem to be like a cozy home for humanity as is described through classical creation accounts. And therefore, it does not seem to be built for or have its purpose human life, which would go against sort of the Genesis account of creation. I think if you see this for the first time, this might seem somewhat persuasive. I'm hoping by the end of the talk that they will seem less persuasive to you, but in good Thomas Aquinas style, I think it's a good practice to first think about what are sort of possible strong objections to the thesis you want to launch. If we go to Revelation, especially the Revelation in the Bible, we get a very different view from these objections, which is that if we look at creation, we do actually see very clear signs of a creator. So if we go, there are multiple texts in the Old Testament, but I think Isaiah is a very beautiful one on creation. So, for thus says the Lord, the creator of the heavens, who is God, the designer and maker of the earth, who established it, not as an empty waste did he create it, but designing it to be lived in. I am the Lord and there is no other. So in some sense, you get a response to all three questions that we had, even if it's more an authority maybe than giving as sort of a syllogism. In Romans, ever since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes of eternal power and divinity have been able to be understood and perceived in what he has made. So Paul here takes it like one step further. He doesn't just say that we live in a created order, but that you should actually be able to learn something about God by studying it carefully. So this is even more, I would say, an optimistic take on what the proper relationship is between the studying of creation and approaching the creator. So that's sort of a short introduction to creation and some possible obstacles there. So next, we want to turn to the Big Bang cosmology and what that can teach us about the universe. But before going there, I think it's useful, in some sense, to take a step back and to realize that we're always going to be reading creation accounts in relationship or while having some conception of what the cosmos is like. And there have been many different ideas of what kind of cosmos we live in over the ages that Judaism and then Christianity have existed. And if we're going to understand what in Revelation, what in theological text that is sort of particular to the understanding of the day, what kind of cosmology they thought we lived in, versus what are sort of the eternal truths, actually having some idea what these cosmologies are is helpful. Also, it will help you to see just how cool and some sort of revolutionary the Big Bang cosmology really was. So if we step back into sort of deep biblical times and think about what cosmology was sort of in the air when something like Genesis was written down. It was something like the cosmology that's described in the Enuma Elish, sort of Babylonian, Sumerian creation accounts. So this is a cosmology where all sort of forces of nature are in some sense divine, they're supernatural. It's kind of capricious universe. It's not obvious that you should be able to find laws or do science in that kind of universe. It is also a cosmos that in some sense is self-creating, or like the creation of the cosmos is sort of coming out of pre-existing forces in the Babylonian account over sort of a saltwater principle and a sort of sweetwater principle that mingle to bring forth the cosmos that we live in. When we read Genesis, there are aspects of that cosmology that persists. If you remember Genesis or even some of the Psalms that describe a creation, the cosmos that's imagined is that of sort of a flat disk that humans inhabit. Then there's a dome that holds back the heavenly waters. And there's an underworld, and sort of also sort of kind of a dome-like underworld that's holding back the waters from below. And if you read the story of Noah, sort of like the flood, these domes, there's sort of like little gates in it that you can open and the water can sort of pour in both from below and from above. That structure is very similar to the Babylonian cosmology. What is extremely different is that this structure now is just created by God. The sun is no longer a god, it's a lamp. The moon is a lamp. The stars are decorations. All the creatures are just spoken into being by God rather than having some sort of capricious supernatural element to them. And all these creatures follow some sort of order or laws. They're spoken into existence. Even though sort of the flat disk dome kind of cosmos is not one that we would recognize as being accurate today, the other things are, like, we're already seeing that this could be a world where the scientific method could work. You would expect there to be patterns and orders that you could uncover. The next really important cosmology for us to consider is the Greek or Aristotelian one. This is the one that's going to be assumed by people like St. Basil of Caesarea, which will show up in this talk, by Augustine, and by St. Thomas Aquinas. This cosmos is sort of spherical. You have the spherical earth at the center, and then you have spherical shells with different heavenly bodies outside of it. It's a beautiful, I mean, if we already in sort of the Genesis cosmology, we could see that there was order and patterns. I mean, this is in some sense the ultimately ordered and well-behaved kind of universe. Here, you can definitely do science. There is one problem with it, however. This is sort of a naturally eternal, infinite in time kind of universe. There's no sort of obvious beginning to what's going on here. And this is something that people like Ian St. Basil, Augustine, Thomas, all have to, in some sense, wrestle with. That it almost seems a little bit sort of imposed on it that you have a beginning to this kind of universe. Now, none of them think that it's super serious. From the beginning, Christian theologians have been saying things like, well, just because a circle or an orbit doesn't have sort of a beginning, if you look at it, if it's there, somebody must have drawn it. And they would have that as an analogy, that it doesn't matter that the shape in some sense is naturally infinite or eternal. It still needs a cause for existing there. And therefore, it still has, in that sense, a beginning. This Aristotelian word or cosmos is replaced in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century by what's sometimes referred to as the clockwork cosmology. this is the what we get during the Enlightenment, during the scientific revolution. It moves the Earth away from the center of the cosmos, first puts the sun there, and later the center of our galaxy, and so forth and so on. It is also one that's very well described by Laws. And the reason it's sometimes referred to as the clockwork universe is that the imagination of the scientists at the time, when they see just how well the cosmos is described by especially Newton's laws of physics, is that once you get sort of the universe started, it can sort of go on forever on its own. So theologically, this coincides with a movement where God is sort of moved a little bit to the side. He's still needed for the initial creative act of sort of setting, like winding up the universe. And maybe he needs to go in and poke a little bit here and there. Then different scientists and different theologians disagree. But you don't have this sense that you have in the Middle Ages of this sort of very strong, tight relationship between the creator and the creation at any one time, when it is primarily a relationship. And I think it's probably more from this sort of scientific revolution and Enlightenment that we get this idea of creation as sort of like a one thing that happens at the beginning than from the biblical accounts that take a much more expansive view, and definitely in the Middle Ages, of what we mean by creation, as said again, primarily as a kind of relationship. This clockwork universe, like its predecessor, is, as I said, like naturally sort of infinite or eternal in time. There's no sort of obvious beginning of this kind of universe. And that is sort of the ideological framework that persists for many hundreds of years into the sort of first decades of the 20th century. That we're just, the universe has been about the same for forever. It had no beginning. But then in the early times, like in the first few decades of the 20th century, there are a couple of different scientific discoveries that sort of starts nudging at this picture in different ways. One has to do with observing the universe. So these are a collection of galaxies. They're not the original observations of Edwin Hubble, who is pictured here, but they're here to illustrate that we start getting good enough telescopes that we can tell that there are other galaxies, these sort of large gravitationally bound collection of stars than our own. And in addition, these telescopes are good enough that they can tell what color of the light is from these galaxies with higher and higher precision. And what Hubble discovers is that, well, I'll say, the third thing is that we start being able to measure how distant galaxies are. So you can measure, you can imagine, because it's a bit of a sidebar, how do you tell if something is close or far away in space? You need some sort of ruler, but you can't do what we would do maybe in the solar system. You can do radar signals and see how fast something bounces back and forth. That works in the solar system. But how do you tell whether a galaxy is nearby or far away? The way that astronomers do that is through so-called standard candles. They find some object that they know that it either always has the same luminosity or its luminosity can be correlated with some other property that's easy to measure. And the first really good one was discovered is it's a kind of variable star called Cepheids. How their luminosity vary has a very simple correlation with how luminous they are. So we get this ruler you can measure distance to galaxies. And when you take these observations, Hubble's observations of the galaxies and their colors and this distance measure, what he finds is that the further away a galaxy is, the redder it is. And one way to interpret that is that the further away galaxy is sitting, the sort of the faster it's moving away. Hubble considers that as one of the possible explanations. he also considers maybe that they're dustier or something like that as well. There's another big discovery that's happening around the same time, which is a theoretical one. This is by Einstein, discovering that the universe can be well described by the theory of general relativity, and about how space itself is curved, or space-time rather, is curved. It is possible to set up the general relativity, or at least it seemed for a while that it was possible to set up the theory of general relativity and still maintain this sort of universe that is the same through time. But this turns out to be a very unstable solution. And it is two sort of great minds independently discover that if we live in sort of relativistic universe, it is naturally going to be a dynamic one. One of them is Alexander Friedman. The other one is Georges Lemaître, Belgian priest physicist. Georges Lemaître has several sort of, can say, natural things going for him to make that initial discovery and what becomes this even more consequential one of that universe must have started from this very dense and hot kind of state and then started to expand rapidly that we refer to as the Big Bang. He was a very talented mathematician and one of the few people that sort of came to understand what the theory of relativity really entails. So he had good sort of both mathematic and physical intuitions. He also ended up doing his PhD in Cambridge at MIT right as these new astronomical observations was coming in. And so he got to see sort of the data and understand the theory at the same time. And that certainly must have helped him to start thinking about what these observations meant. Is it like Hubble sort of interpreted as galaxies moving away? Maybe he sort of wavered a bit on that. And this idea is that we live in a very dynamic universe where space itself is dynamic. And he sort of put those two together to understand that it's actually not that galaxies are moving away that's causing the redshift. It is really the expansion of space itself. And then if a space is sort of expanding over time, if you sort of roll back time, you should get to a universe that at some point back in time was unimaginably dense, and therefore, as not necessarily he worked out, but other people worked out, unimaginably hot at the beginning. This becomes a universe that seems to have a beginning. This was not a popular theory initially. Many people thought it smelled a bit too much, like in the beginning. And it certainly didn't help that Georges Lemaître was a priest. But I think we should probably put most of the burden of why, or like explanation of why this was sort of difficult to get accepted for decades, in that people had this very strong intuition built up over hundreds of years that we live in a cosmos that is sort of the same over time and in space. And it took actually a lot of work to sort of get out of that conviction and start to consider this much more dynamic universe. I cannot help but though speculate that why was it possible for Lemaître to break out of that sort of conviction before it seems anyone else? That has something to do, and we'll come back to this in the second talk, that one of the things that being moored to sort of eternal truths allow you to do is, I think, to be a little bit less attached to sort of the convictions of the day. And that it might make it just a little bit easier when the evidence is pointing in one direction to accept those truths with less prejudice than you otherwise would. That doesn't mean that because you are a practicing Catholic that you are without the same kind of, in some sense, prejudices, like that you're not the child of your day, I think we all end up being. But it does seem like this idea must have, in some sense, occurred to more minds than Lemaître around this time. But for some reason, when that idea occurred to him, it stuck. And him having that, in addition to being part of the scientific and sort of intellectual conversations, which we're talking about a universe infinite in time, that he had this separate conviction that there was a beginning, I think must have been part of it. So the Big Bang. We have something that seems to be a creation kind of at the beginning of our universe. But that is a bit illusory, that to think that the Big Bang, this rapid expansion out of this very dense and hot state, that is the same as the creation, you know, this creating something out of nothing. And the reason for that is that when the Big Bang is happening, this rapid expansion, there's something there to expand. We can't actually go back sort of beyond that initial moment where something is already there and expanding. So instead, we want to think about, though, do we need anything beyond that? There just was that initial very dense and hot state? Do we need a creation out of nothing? Does that concept even make sense? So I want to give you sort of two quotes and then jump to Genesis. And in part of that, just to show you that this idea that maybe you don't need a creation out of nothing, whether or not you have a universe that seems to have a beginning, is not a new one. I think sometimes, even as we try to be faithful to the Catholic intellectual tradition, I think that there are sort of very helpful things there to get, is that we have this idea that there used to be that we had sort of religious explanations for everything, and then we got more and more sort of natural explanations as science progressed. So I just want to give you one example on how it's really always been both natural and supernatural explanations sort of being offered in parallel. And as I said, one of the great things about the proper understanding of creation is that they actually cannot be in conflict. So St. Basil is writing around this homily in 378. And he's writing a homily on creation. But one of the things that he does in this homily is also really engage with some of the intellectual ideas of his time that are not Christian. So this is what he says about some of the Greek philosophers' ideas on whether we have creation from nothing or whether sort of universe can self-create or not. Some Greek philosophers had recourse to material principles and attributed the origin of the universe to the elements of the world. You have the rest of the quote on your sheet, but I just want to sort of paraphrase the rest. So what we have here is an intellectual tradition which has started to find some natural causes within the universe. And because of that, they think that from the random sort of motions of what they call atoms, which you can think about just the most basic particles you can think of, that sort of random motion sort of by chance can bring the universe into existence. So natural forces plus chance gives you the universe. So that's around 400 years ago that the Greeks say that. And then about 800 years later, St. Basil is sort of summarizing their teaching. Now, fast forward about 1600 years from St. Basil, we have Stephen Hawking, very famous physicist. And he says this: because there is a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing, why the universe exists, why we exist. The main thing I want you to do at first is just like notice how similar sort of the ancient Greek explanation and Stephen Hawking's explanations are. First of all, then we imagine sort of like the nothing as somehow having something there, at least some force. I mean, the gravity is not nothing. And the second is this idea that chance or sort of spontaneous sort of bringing together and pulling apart, that is sufficient to explain the universe that is around us. But to this, we have the biblical, the Catholic view that in the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth, that this universe is brought into existence by the creative act of God. Now, I think there are many sort of complaints you can make of both the Greeks and Stephen Hawking's idea that you can have a universe that self sort of self-creates. First of all, that it's logically completely inconsistent to have something be sort of both the cause and the effect of itself. The idea that you have a nothing when you have forces acting is also, I think, it's not what theologically is meant by nothing. And the third one is this strange power that is given to forces. I mean, I think sometimes we say that, okay, a stone falls because of the law of gravity. Like the law is what's causing it to do it. It's a very strange idea if you don't want there to be a God who somehow directs things according to laws. And we'll come back to that, but I just want to plant that idea. We already talked about, if we have creation out of nothing, how does that relate to the Big Bang? So I already said that it can't be the same thing because our horizon, not just of what we can see going back in time, but even of understanding, sort of stops where there's still something there. And that means that we cannot, with science, probe creation out of nothing. We don't know if that sort of initial, like we can't even use the Big Bang to say that the universe for sure has a beginning, even though it's something that looks very, very close to the beginning. Does that mean that the fact that we have the Big Bang, is that theologically insignificant? I don't think it is. I think while it doesn't prove creation out of nothing, it does provide sort of a beautiful icon for us of creation. I mean, this is it is difficult to imagine any theologian thinking of sort of a more beautiful way that sort of the universe could begin, a more impressive way than the Big Bang, if we already believe that we have creation out of nothing. But that brings up sort of another issue, which is that of what does it mean to begin? This is not a trivial thing. It has to do also with that time. It's actually a very tricky concept to ponder what it is, both philosophically and scientifically. Another little sidebar, but it's going to become important, is that when you might already have encountered in science two very different ways to think about time. One is the one if you have started taking some relativity, even sort of very introductory one, where we think about time as a fourth dimension, right? This part where space-time is the concept. And that means that time and space, they have to sort of go together and therefore come into existence together. But the other way that you have probably encountered time, and this might be the one that's more sort of intuitive, is that of measuring a change. So we talk about clocks, right? How do we measure time? We measure how we see how something is changing, and that is how we see what time is. In both cases, time and matter, or time and space, are completely bound together. And that means that you can't have sort of a beginning of things and a beginning of time separately. Like, time is something that must be created as well as the material order. You have several quotes on your handout. I'm going to jump to the two last ones, so that of Thomas and of Lemaître that we've already encountered. Just so this is something that Augustine understood, something that Thomas understood, that what it says that things are said to be created in the beginning of time, not as if the beginning of time were a measure of creation, but because together with time, heaven and earth were created. Lemaître, who thinks about time, I think in both this way, this kind of change, as well as a dimension as a part of sort of space-time, has this beautiful poetic quote in Nature Commentary: "The beginning of the word happened a little before the beginning of space and time," which you can definitely ponder what that what that would mean. But I think you can see that it's trying to capture some of this mystery of how to even think about what it means for space and time to come into existence. So if we have this beginning, whatever that means, why did God create a universe with a beginning? You could imagine that maybe he wanted to create a universe that was infinite in time to be sort of an icon of his infinity. But instead, he chose to create some like a world with a beginning. Aquinas thinks that this one of the reasons for that is that a world or a universe with a beginning, it's more evident, like it's more clear that that needs a cause. Now, if you have read Aquinas' five proofs for God's existence, you will know that he doesn't think that that something having a beginning is necessary for it needing a cause. Just the fact that something exists means that it needs a cause for its existence. This comes back to creation being primarily a dependency rather than sort of a moment of coming into being. But he thinks it's more obvious and intuitive to us that something needs a cause if it has a beginning. And that this is at least one of the reasons why God created a universe with a beginning. And for a long time, the only sort of reason we had to hold that was because of revelation. And I think thinking about the Big Bang as an icon of a beginning is a scientific discovery that's bringing that concept of creation to the forefront and sometimes forcing us to ponder where does the universe come from. One of the things that it also does is that it turns, in some sense, the whole universe into a story. And that's what I want to spend sort of the last few minutes on, is telling a little bit of that story, what happened after the Big Bang, and how that relates to some of Aquinas' thought. So the Big Bang sort of cosmology goes beyond talking only what happened at the very first moment when we get this initial rapid expansion. It tells us that in the first sort of seconds to minutes, the different elementary particles starts coming into existence. And then the particles and the photons, the light particles, live this sort of deeply intertwined existence for a few hundred thousand years old while the universe is expanding and cooling. Around 400,000 years, the universe has cooled down enough that the light, the photons, don't have enough energy to kick out electrons that come bound to protons. And at that point, sort of atoms and light sort of separate and start living their separate lives. We have this beautiful image of that from the cosmic microwave radiation. So this is what the sky looks like if you look very carefully at microwaves. This was discovered first in 1960s. Monsieur Lemaître found out about the discovery of this cosmic microwave background a few days before he died. And it was sort of the final proof for that the Big Bang had really happened. Because that was the only explanation why we have this sort of low-level radiation at the right frequency all over the sky. It is this separation of light and matter, and then the photons are traveling through space and time. After this initial sort of separation of light and matter, the matter, or mostly matter that we can't see, so-called dark matter, starts to come together to form the stars and the galaxies that we know today. And this is the short movie that I'm going to cut off at some point, but it shows how cosmic structure emerges over time. So this is a simulation. As we are sort of forwarding the Big Bang cosmology because of the combination of matter and energy operating under different kinds of natural forces. In this case, it's mainly gravity. We do get galaxies forming pretty quickly, actually because of JWST, maybe too quickly. You might have seen about a year ago, you might have seen some headlines that JWST has broken Big Bang cosmology. That is not true. Something like the Big Bang definitely happened. What it has done is that it has challenged, I would say, the most common current model of exactly how it unfolded by showing us that there are galaxies and stars sooner than we thought there would be. But the main thing that I want to focus on is that we have this unfolding of creation over time and how we should think about that. And St. Thomas has this very, I think, helpful way of thinking about creation as being really split in three parts. One is the creation, which is instantaneous. That's basically the very first line in Genesis, in the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth. And then if you think about what happens next in Genesis, we have sort of a series of distinctions or pulling apart separations. The first one being that of light and darkness, but that you have of the waters and of the land and water as well. And after that, you have a series of sort of decorations or adornments. So each of these things that have been sort of pulled apart now get their proper things existing within them. Well, this is something I want to start to think about. I'm just wondering if this actually is how one has to think about sort of the emerging sort of structure within a historical or evolutionary universe, something that sort of unfolds over time, that you do, like the way that you, if once you have created the whole universe out of nothing, the way that you continue to have new things emerging is really by pulling apart where it's matter or light, or different kinds of matter, to then be able to, and then as a part of that, you start basically adorning the different parts of the universe. I think the final thing that I want to touch on is sort of the follow-up of this, which is how we should think about the origins of all this sort of beautiful structure, of these galaxies and the stars, how they can come into existence out of what seems like a very sort of hot and dense and chaotic kind of beginning. Because what I want to, I think, probably end on is that one of the criticisms or one of sort of the ideas of modernity, sort of against creation, is that we have, that the universe is just coming in, like, okay, we might not know where the whole universe comes from, but if we look back in cosmic history, we seem to have this sort of chaotic, hot mess that then by chance gives us the galaxies and the stars. And even if you read Genesis, that might be one way to interpret what the second verse of Genesis says, which is that the earth was without form or shape, with darkness over the abyss and a mighty wind sweeping over the waters. That also sounds like, in addition, like you have sort of a formless, chaotic beginning. This is something that Thomas Aquinas doesn't think that interpretation of Genesis just doesn't make sense from a philosophical or theological point of view. So I'm not going to read the quote, but just to paraphrase, you can't have order come out of disorder. The effect cannot be more ordered than the cause. So what he's going to say is that if you're going to have this sort of beautiful order that we have now in the universe, you must have a deeper order at the beginning. And this is actually also what the science teaches us. While superficially it might look like the sort of the deep origins of the universe looks kind of chaotic, that is not what the physics or even the astrophysics is telling us. But rather we start with a universe with an intense degree of order, and over time, we globally get more disorder, so second law of thermodynamics. But then sort of the mysterious thing is that accompanying this sort of increase of global disorder, you also get the emergence of these sort of pockets of extreme complexity and order. And I think St. Thomas would have no problems with that. I think to him, that would be something that would seem very, very sensible. So I'm going to go straight to what I want to go back to, the sort of original questions that we had and some of the answers that we have looked at here. So remember that the sort of the three objections that I put out at the beginning was that the universe seems to be well described by impersonal forces, so you don't need God to create it. That it's all chaos and destruction, so that's the opposite of what you would expect from a good creator. And that it's just too large to have as its purpose human beings. But to that, the tradition, especially Thomas Aquinas, gives three very, I think, robust answers. The universe cannot create itself. That is logically impossible. Instead, it is in this sort of relationship of extreme dependence on its creator at any moment of time, not just when it was originally brought into existence out of nothing. Two, that when we actually look carefully at the universe, especially with the tools of science, we see a science that's characterized by order and creativity and beauty, which points just not towards that there is a creative force at the root of it all, but a creative mind and a creative love. And finally, three, the universe was indeed made to show forth God's goodness through many kinds of goods. So this is why is there more than one thing in the universe? And humanity, sort of being at the horizon of creation, spanning the chasm between heaven and earth, was made to show forth this goodness in a more profound way than all other created material things. And the fact that the universe is large, it's not a very good counter-argument. If we want to have a cosmos that follows the laws of physics, such as we know them, it had to be large to be able to bring forth a planet, a living planet such as our own. Now, there might be other living planets, but even if there isn't, it would not be against what we know about God that he could have created this whole sort of cosmos just for us to figure out and enjoy the beauty of the stars. I mean, remember, this is the same God who stepped into his own creation to save us. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.